Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is Red Box. I'm Matt Chorley with the Best of My Times radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. Don't forget, I'm interviewing David Cameron later this week. So if you've got any questions you want to ask him, get in touch. Drop me an email, matt.chorley@times.radio. That's the same email address, by the way, if you want to get in touch to come on the quiz. Can you get to number 10? We had a guy on today who was completely hopeless and couldn't even get the first question right. So if you think you can do better than that, then get in touch, matt.chorley@times.radio. Now then, a properly fascinating episode today. I spoke to Deborah Mattinson, Gordon Brown's former pollster, now just an expert in what's going on in those red wall seats the Tories took from Labour and what might be happening there this time round. So take a listen. Imagine this. The man who hankered to be Prime Minister, angry that his old mate got there first, finally getting into number 10 and enjoying a surge in the polls for handling a crisis well, only to find the honeymoon was short-lived with serious questions about what exactly he wanted to do with the top job after all. Perhaps Boris Johnson has got more in common with Gordon Brown than he'd like to admit. Well, few people know the highs and lows of being inside a political operation better than my guest today. Deborah Mattinson began working as a pollster for the Labour Party in the 1980s when things were so bad she stopped writing down what voters said. She became Gordon Brown's pollster, guiding him through his golden years at the Treasury before his slightly less golden move into Downing Street, his short-lived honeymoon and, of course, Labour's defeat. Since then, she's been outside the Westminster machine, running the polling firm Britain Thinks, chronicling in particular Labour's decline amongst its traditional voter base, which she does brilliantly in her new book, Beyond the Red Wall, Why Labour Lost, How the Conservatives Won and What Will Happen Next, which is out today. And Deborah joins me in the studio. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, so when I was discussing with my wife that you were coming on today, the first thing she said was, who does polls? I've never done one or a focus group. So, and this comes up all the time whenever we talk about polls, and people will text in and say, well, I've never done one. So explain, first of all, your role as a pollster, how you find people to respond to polls.
So, there are different ways that you can do a poll. You can do a poll online. In the olden days, pre-COVID, you could do a poll face-to-face. You could do one over the telephone. And how we find people depends on the method. Obviously, if it's face-to-face, then it is literally going out in the street and stopping or knocking on people's doors. And it's the same for focus groups. Obviously, at the moment, we're doing our focus groups online as well. But typically what we do, we at Britain Thinks, like most other agencies like ours, have a network of people up and down the country, and we will decide who we want to listen to, and they will go out and find those people for us using a mix of methods. So they'll knock on doors, they'll wait outside a school playground, they'll go to a shopping mall. They also will have a kind of, you know, database of people. They may go to particular places if you want an unusual cohort of people. But there are lots of different ways. So I'm afraid if Mrs. Chorley hasn't been stopped, I don't know why.
And in terms of the when you have an opinion poll of maybe 1,000, 1,200 people in that sample, how do you make sure that that is then representative of the country and not just that group of people that you spoke to?
So if you have a large enough sample, and, you know, for the whole population, more than 1,000 would be fine, 2,000 is better. But what you'll then do is when you get the data back, you look at it and you match it to statistics for the known population, and then you may do some weighting. So if you find that you've got too many or too few of a particular group of people, you'll adjust it statistically so that you get the right proportion of people.
So if in your sample 40% are women, then you'll put a bit more weight
exactly
on the women,
so exactly it becomes 50-50. Yes, exactly that.
That all makes sense. Now, I suppose this is maybe the million-dollar question before we go piling into all the work you've done over the years, but how much attention do people actually pay to politics?
Not very much. And this is always the most sobering thing for all politicians. I have literally done focus groups.
And political journalists.
And political journalists, of course, exactly. You know, you think people are hanging on your every word, and sadly they're not. And, you know, I've literally done focus groups with the politicians sitting, you know, behind the screen watching, and people have not recognised him or her, you know, and I've actually done focus groups where people haven't recognised the Prime Minister.
And how, so when you've got the politician behind the screen and they don't recognise them, how do they react to that?
Well, actually, that's probably easier than hearing people say really, really, really mean things about them, which also happens.
Who's reacted most badly? Can you tell us which politician?
I do remember Ed Balls, actually, sitting the other side of a screen and telling me that he was on a low-carb diet. And what they do in these sort of, they call them viewing facilities, they lay out lots of sort of sandwiches and crisps. And he said, no, 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 I'm not having any of that because I'm on a low-carb diet. And then people started talking and being a little bit rude about him. And I glanced over nervously. One of my colleagues was running the group and he was just shoving sandwiches in his face. Yes.
Well, yeah. Oh, well, we could all do that. We could all appreciate that. So let's go right back to the beginning again then. When you started doing this job, was it back in the 1980s for the Labour Party?
Yes, so the first election I worked on was 1987.
And so what sort of state were Labour in then? And I read previously you talked about how when you spoke to people, they were so rude about Neil Kinnock that you sort of stopped passing that on.
Yeah, I mean, it became really difficult. And Charles Clarke, who was running Neil Kinnock's office at the time, I think felt that he needed to a certain extent to kind of protect Neil, whose confidence was quite low at that point. But people were very rude about him. They were very rude about Labour. It really felt like Labour was going nowhere. And it was a difficult message to convey, you know, because, my job is to be, obviously, to be truthful, but also to be constructive. And that's true with any client that I'm dealing with. You know, there's no point in giving somebody terrible, terrible news. I also need to think strategically about how I can tell them what to do about that.
And one of the things that you do, and I know you've been on the show lots of times before, and it's when you ask what seem like slightly left-field questions, you know, if this politician was a car, what would they be, or whatever, you know, and actually you get real insight to people. And I was reading you, when you asked back then, if you asked people what they thought of, what words they thought of when you asked about the Labour Party, they talked about holidays in Blackpool, taking the bus, live in a council house, smokes a pipe, all quite old-school views of the Labour Party. So how do you get from that to this?
A new dawn has broken, has it not? And it is wonderful. We always said that if we had the courage to change, then we could do it. And we did it.
Tony Blair there in 97, he's not a very holiday in Blackpool, taking the bus type of guy.
No, he's not. And you know, in some ways that was why it worked, and it marked a real sort of sea change. It took a long time. I mean, you know, the 10 years, you know, it was really, really a long haul, and lots of things had to happen. Gosh, I mean, where to start? It was about the policy offer. It was about the people presenting the policy offer. It was about the values. I mean, by the time we got to 97, we'd had the pledge card in that election with those sort of five policies. I spent weeks and weeks testing those policies to make sure we had exactly the right things that signposted to people, you know, a different approach and a different way of thinking, and things that they found really appealing as a kind of hook. But in the end, you know, when I look back on it a few weeks after that election and ask myself the question, why did people vote Labour? They weren't voting for a better NHS, although they wanted that. They weren't voting for smaller class sizes, although they wanted that. They were voting for a different way of doing politics. And that was what, at that point, they seemed to be getting, or they felt that they were getting, to the point where And this is interesting in two ways, I think. Labour wanted me to go out and do some focus groups with people that hadn't voted Labour. Even after a landslide victory, at that point, the team in charge were very keen to understand, you know, why some people hadn't come over to them. It was really hard to find people who would admit that they hadn't voted Labour, because there was this sort of groundswell of feeling that, you know, the mood of the nation was behind them.
It's like people who, you can't find anyone now who backed the Iraq war.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. Exactly.
And so at that point, Tony Blair moves into number 10. You're working for Gordon Brown, who's in number 11, and he becomes one of the most popular politicians in the country.
I think people often forget this, but Gordon Brown was the most popular politician in Britain for 10 years. I mean, you know, he really, and that double act really worked well. You know, he really underpinned the offer because he had a lot of trust. You know, actually, back to your, you know, if that politician was a car, Gordon was a Volvo. Why? Because he was solid and reliable.
Not too exciting and flash, and but, you know, he did the job.
Yeah, and actually as a double act, they worked really well. I mean, Tony was a bit more sort of exciting, if you like, and Gordon was, but he was solid, reliable, it really mattered.
And that, obviously, famously, the relationship between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair was not always at its best. In that situation, are you, particularly when Gordon Brown was trying to become Prime Minister, were you polling things on Tony Blair to try and find weaknesses or, you know, other rivals to become Prime Minister at that time?
No, I mean, I never did that. I mean, I think in some ways the clash between the two has been slightly overstated over the years. They actually, I think, mostly until probably until right at the end, worked pretty well together. And certainly we never did that. I mean, I definitely did work, and I talk about it in my first book, Talking to a Brick Wall. I definitely did work looking at how Gordon could make that transition most effectively from being, if you like, the number two in politics to being the number one. But no, we never looked at, you know, at colleagues to sort of pick holes in them.
So, of course, you touched on it there, but he eventually, after a lot of waiting, he eventually moved from the Treasury to number 10.
I will try my utmost. This is my promise to all of the people of Britain. And now let the work of change begin.
So that's Gordon Brown, outside number 10, long-held ambition fulfilled. And to start with, his popularity just rocketed.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going to Chequers and doing a presentation of a, you know, a big update of polling and focus groups to the Cabinet. And I it was almost embarrassing because it was sort of so glowing and so positive. And as I'd been putting the presentation together, I'd been looking for some things that I could say that were not going right, because I felt it just felt too glossy almost. It was a fantastic start.
And it was partly as a result, and this will all sound a bit familiar, we're dealing with a succession of crises. There was a terror attack, there was foot and mouth, and he was seen to be, again, like solid, reliable, rising to the occasion.
He was absolutely the politician that people wanted at that point. We had the, you know, the terrorist attacks, as you say, foot and mouth. He cancelled his holiday. I mean, this was, in a way, this absolutely played to Gordon's strengths. He wasn't that comfortable, I suspect, being on holiday anyway. I think he was, you know, he was wearing a suit on the beach.
Yes,
exactly. And so he did. And, yeah, it was, he was, the, you know, the right guy for those very difficult times.
So that lasted for the whole summer in 2007 until this happened.
And I think that's not likely that we'll have an election, because I want to get on with the business of governing.
Not likely when? What's the period?
Not likely this year, not likely whatever dates you were suggesting.
Not likely next year?
I want to get on with the business of governing.
So that was the famous election that never was. It was so much talk of that in the sort of, in fact, this time in 2007, and then he suddenly pulled it. And that became quite a big turning point,
yeah,
didn't it?
It did, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was mismanaged from start to finish, really. There were many, many opportunities where Gordon and the team could have rode back and said, we're not doing this. Actually, if they'd done it just a week or two before at Labour Party conference, the story would have been over and things would then have been very different. I think the Tory Party conference that followed the following week would have not gone so smoothly and brilliantly, because they were all pulling together thinking there was going to be an election, and everything that happened afterwards, it made Gordon look weak. I mean, it was the right thing to do to consider going early. I mean, you know, you talked earlier about failure and how quickly things turn around. Actually, we did a big analysis and found that 3 months in tended to be as good as it got for any leader. And the best that you could hope to do was to maintain your ratings at that point.
That's really interesting. So 3 months is is the best you can hope for.
And if you think about it with Boris Johnson, that's kind of where we've ended up. There might have been a little bit of an extra few weeks because of COVID and him getting COVID and everything that happened then. But actually, I mean, it's been an extreme version, but an extreme version of a fairly familiar pattern.
If you like what you're hearing, you can listen to the whole of my Times Radio show, either listen back on the Times Radio app, or you can listen live Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. We'll have more on the episode after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
So he clung on anyway. It went all the way to 2010, and things just seemed, you know, it was one of those things where sometimes politicians just attract bad luck and things seem to go from bad to worse, famously with this moment.
Should never have put me with that, like, woman. Whose idea was that?
I don't know, I can see.
Let's see, I think. It's just ridiculous.
I'm not sure they'll go with that one.
They will go with it.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman, you know. Said she used to be late. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Bigoted woman. At least you don't have your head in your hands, as Gordon Brown famously did when he had that clip played to him during the 2010 election. But part of the reason it became such a big thing, I think, was because, and in fact, you then wrote a book after the election in 2010, Talking to a Brick Wall, How New Labour Stopped Listening to the Voter and Why We Need a New Politics. That was sort of emblematic of that, wasn't it? It felt like he was just completely out of touch with a long time Labour voter.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the same had happened with Tony before him. And, you know, New Labour, when you ask how did we get from 87 to 97, it was very much about listening to voters. I don't mean listening to voters and just serving up exactly what they wanted, but listening to voters and bearing that in mind as the whole package was put together. And I think that once people stopped hearing things they wanted to hear, they stopped listening so hard. And it's interesting that Mrs. Duffy moment really was very prescient when you roll forward to the Red Wall, because some of those attitudes, rashes I heard everywhere.
Yeah, well, let's skip out. I mean, I hate to do this to him because obviously he's enjoying a bit of return to the limelight. So let's skip over this sort of the Ed Miliband years to some extent. I'm talking to Deborah Mattison, Labour pollster, former Labour pollster, and now author of Red Wall: Why Labour Lost, How the Conservatives Won, and What Will Happen Next. So in a way, it was sort of took a while for the losing of those ties with the Labour heartlands to play through. And we saw it first with Scotland, long held sense of being taken for granted and all of that. And that Scotland fell and they ended up with one MP. Yep. And then it was sort of history sort of repeated itself all over again, the north of England. So tell us then what you've done with your book and the Red Wall and trying to get to the bottom of why Labour lost those places, which they'd held in some cases, 100 years, in some cases, forever.
In so many cases, forever. And I think what Natalie was setting out then is also true, that it wasn't about one thing. It wasn't a thing that happened overnight. It wasn't a thing that happened, you know, just in that election. This is a story that had been waiting to happen for a long, long time. And what I think had happened was this group of voters had been neglected. It's interesting, reflecting back on my career, that, you know, in all those years that I was doing polling for the Labour Party, I never did polling in a red wall seat. Literally, not once. Why? Because Labour took them for granted. Labour just assumed they didn't need to. And, of course, the Tories also didn't do polling there because they thought their Labour seats, we're never going to win those. So what that meant was that this was a group of people whose views were simply never heard. They were completely neglected. And that had some really practical implications for the people that lived there. But it also meant their voices were never heard. And, you know, that one of the things I've tried to do with the book is to, you know, really kind of bring those voters' voices to life and kind of give them a voice.
And so what did you find? How did you go about doing that? Where did you go?
So I chose three constituencies. Darlington, actually, because I was born there. No other particularly good reason, but it's a great example of one of those northeastern seats. I did Hindburn, which is in Lancashire, and Stoke Central. So, you know, a bit of a mix. And what I did in each of the places was to run focus groups with people who had voted Labour in the past, usually never anything else, and had voted Tory for the first time. And then I also did some what we call in the trade kind of ethnographic research. I spent time in people's houses chatting to them, you know, seeing them go about their daily business, kind of really getting a flavour of their lives. And, you know, you get a lot more out of people, get to know them much better in that kind of setting to really kind of understand where they were coming from.
And what was it that they were telling you?
So they were quite angry, you know, and a bit sad as well, like Natalie. I mean, a lot of them said what she said, which is, you know, they'd voted Labour all their lives. Their parents had voted Labour all their lives. Their grandparents had voted Labour. When they became old enough to vote, their mum or their granny had said, you know, you vote Labour, don't you? These were people who were proud of their local community, but also very sad. And everywhere I went, there was a sort of nostalgia for a glorious past in their local community that had actually sort of evaporated. So in Darlington, it was the railways. In Accrington, Hindburn, it was the Norrie brick, this fantastic sort of brick factory that they'd had. In Stoke, of course, it was the potteries. All of those, plus the mines, plus everything else, all of that industry had evaporated and the jobs that were there were very poor. And people felt their children had no future.
And I suppose it's that thing of it was that decline and the sense that nobody cared, you know, because it wasn't. You know, if you're in a swing seat, if something goes wrong, people turn up with pots of money and promises and all that sort of thing. Yeah. But if you're being taken for granted, then nothing happens.
It was worse than nobody cares, though, actually. It was that they were being judged adversely. And this was particularly a problem for Labour. There was a sense, and this is the kind of two tribes for Labour, where you've got, you know, working class communities like the Red Wall, and then you've got the urban people who more like to have voted Remain, who were younger, who were educated, who were graduates. And the Red Wallers felt that the Remainers, you know, the urbanites, looked down on them. And it was exactly that Mrs. Duffy-type conversation playing out.
It was interesting, reading the book, there's a sort of real pivot point, and you may have a different pivot, but it felt for me, there's the bit immediately after the election, and everyone still quite likes Boris Johnson, you know, give him a good wind. Even when coronavirus hits, there's a sense of, nobody's ever had to deal with this before, he's doing his best, we're wishing him well, the rally to the flag and all that sort of stuff. And then the pivot point feels like it was this.
I don't regret what I did. As I said, I think you know, reasonable people may well disagree about how I thought about what to do in these circumstances, but I think that what I did was actually reasonable in these circumstances.
That's obviously Dominic Cummings, though, explaining his strange little trip to Barnard Castle. And this is one of those things where, you know, the Westminster bubble, the lobby, they move on and we talk about, you know, the internal market boom and all that. This Dominic Cummings thing got cut through like almost nothing else this year.
Yes. I went back to some of the people I'd interviewed earlier in the year after the Dominic Cummings. I mean, I didn't know it was coming. I'd arranged to do it anyway, but they were really, really angry. Even one of them, Michelle, who runs the butty shop in Accrington, said to me, oh, I'd forgotten about that. And then having reminded her, she was sort of almost frothing at the mouth with anger. And it's interesting because, you know, you can't really overplay how important Boris Johnson was personally in their decision. One person said he's de-snobbified the Tory party. He'd given them the licence to vote Tory for the first time. With his persona, with his patriotism, with his positivity, they really liked him. And they were so disappointed. I have to say, I think they're still, to a degree, willing him to succeed. But the kinds of things people said, there was a chap called Ian, who's a plumber in Accrington. He said, we voted for Bold, but we've ended up with Waffle. And Colin, who's a builder in Stoke, said, be strong, man, get a grip, fight back. It was just, you could see him sort of weakening before his eyes. It wasn't the strong leader he'd voted for.
Well, let's listen to Boris Johnson the morning after the election, where at least at that point he appeared to acknowledge that he was being lent votes.
Your hand may have quivered over the ballot paper as before you put your cross in the Conservative box. And you may intend to return to Labour next time round. And if that is the case, I am humbled that you have put your trust in me and that you have put your trust in us. And I and we will never take your support for granted.
So I suppose that's the big question then. Given your experience over sort of 30-odd years of the ups and downs of the Labour Party, was the election in December a blip? Or is this a permanent schism between the sort of the younger graduate metropolitan Labour Party and the old Labour Party, which lost Scotland, lost large parts of the North and the Midlands? Is this a blip? Is there a way back?
I think there's a way back, but it's very, very much up to Labour now. And of course, it's up to the Conservatives as well, because I think, you know, Boris Johnson, that speech on the steps of Downing Street would have been a very powerful for Red Wallers. It would have been absolutely acknowledged what they felt. But now expectations are very high and they're watching very carefully and they're already quite disappointed. So there's definitely a tiny bit of a, you know, chink in the armour there. But it's going to be up to Labour how they handle that. And they're going to have to do some very deep soul searching, I think, to sort of get this right.
I suppose I do have to ask you, what do people think about Keir Starmer?
So, I mean, he's made quite a good start, actually. He's definitely better than what went before. And, you know, just to be really clear, what happened in the Red Wall was not all down to Jeremy Corbyn, but it definitely helped. I mean, you know,
they've become multipliers, haven't they?
It absolutely,
Brexit,
it sort of, it became
decline,
sort of turbocharged. Yes, like suddenly here was this guy who represented, in a way, all of these sort of, you know, snooty London graduates, and whose politics seemed to be so different. But Keir Starmer's made a good start. He seems very competent. That's fantastic. They don't feel they know him well enough. And that's what he's going to have to do. He's going to have to set out his stall and show what his values and priorities are. And they need to be values and priorities that the people in the Red Wall can tune into and say, yes, you know, he gets me.
And if there was a by-election in one of those seats that you went back to right now, would the Tories still win it, do you think?
I think a by-election would... By-elections are always slightly weird and different. I've worked on so many of them over the years. And I think that it gives people a chance to sort of... you know, stage a protest without risking the opposition actually winning government. So I would think a by-election would be incredibly difficult, actually, for the Tories. Yes.
So in a way, it would do, Keir Starmer could do one of those to show that he was...
Yes, that's quite right, yeah.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box podcast. You can now listen back to my whole show on the Times Radio app, where you can also now listen to all of the Times podcasts, including Red Box 2. Make sure you subscribe and review the Red Box podcast wherever you listen. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.